Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl. Someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine. Boom, boom. That, Dominic, as of course you'll know, as a top historian of the 60s, was the Beatles, Her Majesty.
Was it?
Yes, it was.
I felt that you didn't really... You only approached that half-heartedly, Tom, by your standards. So we meet in the wake of your absolutely stellar Hercule Poirot, and by those very high standards, I felt you the Liverpudlian accent was unless that was your Liverpudlian accent.
No, it wasn't. No. Well, I wasn't singing it as Paul McCartney. I was singing it as a tribute to the musical tradition that the Beatles embodied, and indeed as a tribute to Her Majesty.
There were levels of nuance in there that I didn't appreciate.
Well, that's why I'm here to tease them out for you, Dominic.
Yeah, thank you. That's very kind.
And talking of teasing out, the reason that I picked on that was partly because I know the lyrics, so that was easy. But also because actually I think there's quite a lot of meaning in there that we could pick out. So we've got the Platinum Jubilee of the Queen coming up. So there'll be lots of people, Capel Loft preeminent among them, who will be wanting to tell the Queen that they love her a lot. And there'll be lots of people getting a metaphorical belly full of wine.
Yes.
Because we've got a holiday, haven't we? And there are all these kind of these cakes and things, that the Platinum Jubilee cake and stuff. That
apparently very
will be
complicated
having.
To make.
No, I thought it was very easy with just that you just add lemon or something.
No, I read an article. Oh, it was in The Guardian, I think. So what do
you
expect?
Probably wrong then, isn't it?
Anyway, yes, we're just wittering. So for people who don't, for outsiders, we should say it's the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. It's a moment of seismic significance for every right-thinking Briton, isn't it, Tom?
Yes.
And we thought we'd do a special Jubilee podcast. And Tom, we've got a guest, haven't we? A very exciting guest.
We do indeed. And so we have Francis Christie, who is the deputy chairman of Sotheby's, who are kindly sponsoring this episode. And Francis, I mean, with your surname being Christie, you must be as bored of people making jokes about that as I am of people making jokes about Spider-Man.
Is the deputy chairman of Christie's called Francis Sotheby?
That so would also be cool. It's not quite as cool as Christie at Sotheby's, I think, obviously, because I am Christie at Sotheby's.
Of course. Your area of specialisation is modern British Irish art, a well-known face on the Antiques Roadshow. But specifically, you're here because you have curated a special kind of festival, a Platinum Jubilee festival at Sotheby's, which will be going on from... When is it? End of May through to
end
June?
End of May till the middle of June, and we'll have stuff going on right to the end of June.
And that's going on in... At New Bond Street,
at New Bond Street, right in the middle, 34 to 35, free and open to the public.
And you've got celebrities coming in to give talks. You've got Andrew Roberts, is that right? And
we've got loads of things going on. We've got talks for kids, from Michael Mapurgo up to a Battle of the Bears.
Battle of the Bears.
They've got dancing bears from the Balkans.
Paddington versus Winnie the Pooh.
Oh,
so not gladiatorial.
Not gladiatorial. But although, I mean, you could put in some. I'm sure you could put in some ideas to making it gladiatorial. But Battle of the Bears, we're very excited about. We've got a Battle of the Queens as well. Victoria versus Queen Elizabeth the First.
You know, we had the World Cup of Kings and Queens.
Yeah.
Actually, I think Elizabeth II, she got to the semi-finals, didn't she?
Did she?
And who was she against?
I think she was against Athelstan.
And who was the winner?
Athelstan.
We thought it would be Elizabeth I who did make
it. You haven't got an Athelstan theme at your Sotheby's exhibition.
Sadly not, but I can make a suggestion.
It's not too late.
Well, let's see if we can work it in today. Because today's podcast, we're structuring it around six items that you have chosen from the exhibition that you're staging, each one of which highlights a distinctive aspect, not just of the Elizabethan age, but of Elizabeth II herself and our relationship to her. So what is the first that you have chosen?
So I think let's go for the most obvious one that hopefully everyone would recognise anyway. And that's the Andy Warhol portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. Well, obviously we're on a podcast, so people can't see the image. Yeah. But shall I describe it?
Do.
It's as lots of people know, Andy Warhol loved popular images. So he would take photographs of celebrities and people. And he once said, I want to be as famous as the Queen of England. So it was apt then when he made her one of his subjects.
So annoying all the Scots and Welsh and...
Yeah, and Northern Irish, Northern Irish, don't forget them.
Yeah.
So he took one of the formal portraits from the 77 Silver Jubilee by someone called Peter Grudgeon. And he styled that photo, I guess, with colour in his own, with his own celebrity treatment. And I guess that in itself could have been quite controversial at the time because, you know, perhaps the Queen is above celebrity treatment.
So I'm kind of looking at it at the moment. She's got kind of Joker style, bright red lips, hasn't she? She looks like a kind of Gotham City villain.
And with purple face.
Yes.
Purple skin, rather, and deep blue hair.
But I don't think the Queen is above celebrity, and I don't think she ever was. So some people might see this as the collision of the celebrity with something sacred, almost, dare I say, sacral, Tom.
We'll come to that, I'm sure.
But, but I would say the Queen, when she born, 1926, so she's born into a world where the celebrity culture already exists through gossip magazines and sort of picture post type things. I mean, I know that's its heyday comes a little bit later, but that the royal, that she was always a celebrity even when she was a little girl, and that Warhol's not doing anything necessarily new with this, I would say. I mean, she's arguably, I know we don't think of her as a celebrity because we think of film stars and rock stars as celebrities, but you could argue she's the single most recognizable celebrity of the 20th century, couldn't you?
I think she is. And I think that's sort of what's so clever about Andy Warhol portraying her like this is that, like, the Brits would never portray her like this, but it takes a kind of American cool New Yorker to show the Queen in the same way that he showed Marilyn Monroe. And I think that that sort of shows what the world thought of her as well, that, you know, she was totally deserving of this amazing accolade in a way, to be treated as the ultimate celebrity. And I guess we wanted to choose this picture because, you know, she's the only queen that's really been in Technicolor, if you like. You know, she's the first monarch to have their coronation filmed.
The other thing about this image, it's your kind of classic Warhol, but it also, is it not very similar to a kind of, it's an icon. I mean, it's literally an icon, as in a kind of orthodox, you know, the sort of icons that you would see in Russian or Greek or Ukrainian churches or something. The sort of, the framing of it is very similar to an icon. And the Queen, that sort of thing that in Eastern Orthodoxy they had with icons, which is they were very kind of unearthly and they were not deliberately not naturalistic and they didn't show emotion and all that sort of thing. I mean, that kind of seems right for the Queen, doesn't it? Because the whole, she's always been as much symbol as kind of a flesh and blood personality.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't have a lot to say. So, I mean, that's kind thanks, of the point of her. Paul. But that is kind of the point of her, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, of course.
You know, you kind of get intimations that in private she's capable.
Absolute, you know, laugh a minute.
Well, I think was it Tommy? Is it Tommy Lascelles or Lascelles?
Tommy Lascelles. Yeah,
Tommy Lascelles said that she's something like. She's not funny, but she's quite a good sport.
Did he say that on The Crown, or did he say?
No, I think. Well, no, yeah, he actually. I'm quoting from a book that I read in preparation for this. Robert Hardman's Queen of the World: The Global Biography.
He's talking in our festival.
Is he? Well, okay. So he could probably absolutely nail that. But his book is, I mean, essentially is a kind of elaboration on this theme, the idea that she's not just the Queen of England or indeed of the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Northern Ireland, or indeed the head of the Commonwealth, but she is, as Dominic, as you said, probably the single most recognisable face to people across the globe. And in that sense, perhaps has a kind of international significance that is greater than we might be, you know, we might think.
Well, we've called our exhibition Power and Image, and then the portraits, the painted portraits, the subtitle is Royal Portraiture and Iconography. It's exactly what you're saying. They become icons. They are icons of their time.
But most monarchs weren't icons, though, Francis, I would say. So most monarchs were kind of flesh and blood,
characters. So our portrait exhibition, we're not focusing on all monarchs. We decided to be really, really niche. And we've gone for the seven queens regnant only. So just the queens. Okay. No kings, just queens.
So here's a question for you. Have you included Matilda?
Not yet.
It's not too late.
Not too late.
And Tom, I know what you're going to ask. Have they included Athelflaed, Lady of the Mercians?
But she wasn't the queen.
Oh, she's a queen of your heart, though.
She's the Lady of the Mercians of my heart. We could
maybe do, you know how, like when they had the Paris Salon and then they had the salon where all the pictures they got rejected. We could do like an alternative
queens. Lady Jane Grey.
But I mean, on the topic of the queen as a global icon, presumably she's the only monarch that Warhol painted. I mean, you know, there are lots of queens.
Yeah, he actually did other queens.
She is the queen.
She didn't. He didn't do any other British monarchs because we've only had the queen.
But he kind of painted.
He did.
The queen,
he did,
of, the queen of Netherlands.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, that did really blasts my whole theory out the water. Then.
Yeah. Sorry.
But how can we never see that image? I mean, we never see that image.
Well, she's not the queen of Britain, is she? No, she's not as famous.
If people say the queen, by and large, they mean Elizabeth II.
They mean our queen.
Yeah, in America. So in the first, every now and again in this podcast, we like to bring in the Naked Gun films. And in the first Naked Gun film, the plot, as you will no doubt recall, Francis, hinges on an attempt to assassinate the Queen. That tells you that she's immediately recognizable to an American audience, because, of course, that film's from an American audience.
She has a very distinctive dress style.
Yes.
And apparently she goes for kind of the very bright primary colors, so that she can be easily seen in walkabouts and things like that.
And people
will recognize her. So that, again, is a kind of an example of branding, I suppose.
Well, she's surely more recognizable for longer than any other world figure in the 20th century. I mean, other people were more famous for 5 years or something. But to have had that kind of longevity and to outlast, I don't know, Mandela, Gorbachev, Reagan, JFK, Nixon, Khrushchev, all these people that she met.
Elvis Presley and Marilyn Monroe, to talk of the Warhol icons. But Dominic, just on the topic of the Queen and her international role, is she anything more than a symbol? Has the role that she's played, say, as head of the Commonwealth?
I was about to say head of the Commonwealth, yeah. Because she really cares about that, doesn't she? I think that's one thing that she does care about.
Well, no, but what's key about it, though, for the people in the Commonwealth, that's also good branding, because essentially your monarch is also the Queen. So even though she's not directly impacting government, she's the figurehead in all of these places. It's almost like it's like the ultimate social media. You're out there in all those countries anyway, regardless of having to sit on a throne there.
Do you know, when the Commonwealth first gets set up, and it was George VI, it wasn't automatic that the Queen was going to become head of the Commonwealth. And basically it was Nehru who swung it for her. So he sent a kind of congratulatory telegram. But do you know the Latin word that was used to describe George VI's role as head of the Commonwealth?
Enlighten us.
It was Princeps, which is the title
that
Augustus Caesar
Like Augustus.
Used. Yeah. To avoid the name Rex, because it would have been offensive, Rex King in Latin. It would have been offensive to the Republic.
They're quite different characters,
in India,
aren't they? Augustus and George VI.
Yes, they are.
The Commonwealth thing, I think, is really important. And I think she has played that role with such gusto and such enthusiasm in a way that I suspect almost anybody else would have put a foot wrong, particularly during the period of decolonization, when she played it so cleverly and she was so sensitive to kind of local local sentiments in the various countries that had once been imperial kind of possessions.
The next object, I think, kind of is linked to what we were saying about her being so recognised. And that's this amazing Punch cartoon by E.H. Shepherd, which was on the banner head of Punch magazine the week of the coronation, which was May 27th, 1953. And for those listeners who can't recall, E.H. Shepherd was the famous illustrator of Winnie the Pooh and Wind in the Willows. And there's an amazing design he did where you've got Eeyore, Toad of Toad Hall dressing up in, you know, regal robes. You've got Pooh trying on a crown. You've got Piglet studying Debrett's, you know, just to get ready.
Ooh. And Dominic, we've got Owl, to whom you were compared by the Times.
I wanted to bring this up, actually. So I was very pleased that you chose this, Francis, because the Times reviewed this podcast and said that Tom was like Tigger and that I was like Owl, wise and skeptical. And I was really...
Tigger's not on this. Tigger's not on
no,
this.
No, Tigger's not even significant enough to be on the banner.
I don't think we should do this one. I think we'll move on to the next one immediately.
And the morning that review came out, I had a message from Tom on my WhatsApp at kind of some ungodly hour, like 6:31 a.m., saying, I can't believe they called you Owl. This is absolutely outrageous. You're not Owl at all. You're Eeyore.
Well, Eos there as well. Eos there as well.
Anyway, apart from reminding us of this splendid notice in the Times, why did you choose this cartoon?
So my point about this is, I think in kind of British collective knowledge, if you like, in the Queen's reign, there are a few characters as recognisable as the Queen. And I kind of think these characters, E.H. Shepherd's drawings of Pooh, they've got to be the most recognisable, just for, you know, generations past, but also kids today still.
Well, Tom has a theory about this.
Okay, so I think in a way it illustrates the opposite, because I think these are Edwardian figures. These are figures very much certainly of before the Second World War. And I would say that the image, if people think of Winnie the Pooh now, they're going to think of the Disney character rather than the E.H. Shepherd. I've had a massive kind of, you know, grumble about this, but
he does have an American accent in Disney, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah. So what this sums up for me is just how old the Queen is. I mean, I know that's a really obvious thing to say when she's celebrating her platinum jubilee. So one of the things that struck me reading this book on Queen of the World, she first travels abroad when she's 20 in 1947, and it's to South Africa with the King and then Queen. And while she's out there, she meets a whole load of veterans of the Boer War, some of whom are actually Boers who fought against the British. But one of them, and Dominic, you'll be excited about this, one of them, he'd been in Sudan in the year that Gordon died.
Oh, my word.
So he'd been on the expedition to
that's
rescue General
exciting.
Gordon.
Yeah.
So the Queen met somebody who knew, who'd been on that expedition. And it just seems insane in 2022 that would even be possible.
That person is still the monarch of the head of state. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, her first prime minister was Winston Churchill, Churchill was a Victorian, you know, born in the Victorian era. And the people that she must have grown, well, the children's books that she read, you know, when she was growing up, would have been Victorian, Edwardian.
Yeah.
Well,
they're changing guard at Buckingham Palace.
But isn't that also her point, that she is like this bridge, not only to the early part of her life, but also a bridge through history? You know, she's the seventh of the seven queens regnant.
Yeah, of course.
And I suppose, I don't, maybe this is where I can slot in my next object, which is we've borrowed one of her coronation Bibles.
Oh, now Tom's very excited about this.
But the point of showing sort of one of her coronation Bibles is that links back to Queen Elizabeth I's coronation Bible and how that's sort of become a thing that all monarchs have a special coronation Bible. And I think to lots of people, they might think, well, you know, why do you need a special? Why can't you just use the normal Bible? I suppose it also shows the degree of detail of our pageantry. You know, we can't just use the same Bible.
Well, the whole point of, before we get into the Bible, the whole point of the Queen to most people is that she's precisely as you say, I would say, that she is an embodiment of a link with generations that have gone before. She's the incarnation of tradition. And that's why actually suppressing her personality has been so important, because it allows you just to see her as this kind of avatar of history.
Yeah.
The other thing about the Bible, I think you would have to have a very particular Bible. I mean, you're not going to use the Good News Bible at your coronation, are you? I mean, Prince Charles might, but I wouldn't approve of it. Anyway, Tom, I know you want to talk about Bibles.
Well, I mean, it's much old. I think it goes back, obviously, much, much further than even the foundation of the British monarchy or the English monarchy. I mean, this is taking us right back to the anointing of kings and queens in the Old Testament. And it's a reminder that the coronation ritual, you know, for the Queen, it's a sacrament. It's a sacramental ritual. And I think she takes it completely seriously. She's a very, very devout Christian. I think she completely believes it. And again, I think that is an aspect of, if you like, her kind of antiquity, because I think she has she believes in, dare I say, the sacral quality of the coronation ritual, and therefore as her role as an anointed monarch, in a way that I would imagine only Capel Loft of her loyal subjects probably still does.
Well, that's why they had the cameras weren't allowed to capture
because
the most intimate moments.
Absolutely sacred moment. Yeah. I wonder whether, you know, when the time comes for the new king to be crowned and anointed, quite what people will make of all this.
But he himself, he wants to be a defender of faith, doesn't he?
He does. And the Queen, I mean, the Queen is perfectly happy with that as well. I mean, she clearly is very devout and committed to her role as Supreme Governor of the Church of England. But she's also perfectly happy with the multi-faith aspect, particularly of the Commonwealth, because you know, there are more Muslims and Hindus in the Commonwealth than there are Christians. So she's never had a problem with that. And in fact, Dominic, we've got our charity thing that we're doing at St. Martin in the Fields on Monday. And actually, there was a multi-faith celebration in St. Martin in the Fields in 1966 to celebrate the you know, the many different faiths of the Commonwealth that generated quite a lot of controversy and a lot of blowback from bishops on this. And so the Queen has Westminster Abbey as a royal peculiar. So basically she can do what she likes with it.
Is that right?
Yeah. So now they have these kind of Commonwealth, you know, spiritual celebrations in Westminster Abbey.
But maybe it's just her approach to faith, as you say. She can totally empathize with everyone else's faith, absolutely, which is what makes her so powerful as the head of the Commonwealth too.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely it. Because she's so deeply Christian and so content and rooted in her faith, other people's faith are not an issue. I think that now, I mean, we live in a kind of thought for the day world. I should explain for non-British listeners, this is a radio slot on the morning news where various people from different faith traditions all come on and say exactly the same stuff.
They do. They basically say exactly the thing that your headmistress says when you're six.
And I think that therefore it has much less kind of potency. And also the kind of the fact that it's a very Protestant ritual. I mean, that's the other thing that I think people will find quite odd. It's quite a sectarian ritual. And again, going back to Elizabeth I, I mean, you know, she was a Protestant queen.
Well, one of the portraits that we've borrowed is one of Mary, Queen of Scots. And I think that going back to the Bible, I think one amazing thing about an amazing Bible is all of that is summed up in this very intimate object. And, you know, we've got to remember books back in the day, that was the ultimate luxury object to have a beautifully bound, illuminated manuscript.
How old is this Bible?
For the coronation, there was a series. There were 25 special copies made to mark the coronation. And with books, it's all about bindings. And the bindings were created and designed by probably the most famous 20th century binders in Britain, who are people called Zangorski and Sutcliffe. They're established in 1901. And they've got the royal warrant. And the 1953 Bible, it's actually got quite a cool geometric pattern on it. So I suppose it reflects that sort of Britain.
Yeah, it does.
It's very 50s kind of, it's very 50s design, isn't it?
And then there's, I mean, cathedral.
You can't miss that it's regal, because there's about 15 crowns on it.
Yeah. And is it the King James version?
It can't be any other. Yeah, it can't be any other.
It'd be ludicrous to use the Good News Bible to be crowned.
It could be Revised Standard Version, or I don't know, whatever.
I think you've got to use the King James, haven't you? I think it's un-British not to. When Charles becomes king, this to me will be the absolute litmus test to whether I support him on their nature. And of course, you don't support him anyway, because you're on record as saying in a succession crisis, you're backing Prince Edward.
I am.
I'm
on record as being his bannerman. Yes, I think he'd be a wonderful. I think he'd be a wonderful king.
Is that just because he's the youngest? Or?
No, it's because he said to Tom what he clearly says to all writers that he meets. I enjoyed your book,
so I've pledged my sword to him. Yeah, and I shall be honoured.
Seconds
to his
before
defense.
He, I think seconds before he met you, someone whispered in his ear: Tom Holland, author, not Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's enough of your honestly, Dominic.
Right, I think we should take a break now. We will see you after the break for more sober.
Right, royal.
Yeah, right, royal. So
we've done quite well. We've done half of them, I think.
We've done halfway. We're halfway through the top six artifacts from Sotheby's exciting exhibition about the Queen and her Jubilee, and we'll see you after the break for three more.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. In the first half, as you may remember, we dealt in a very profound and serious way with the three first artifacts that Francis Christie has chosen for their exciting exhibition about the Jubilee and about the life and times of Queen Elizabeth II. And now, Francis, you're going to surprise us with number four. So what's number four?
Because we were so serious in the first half that maybe we should go for like proper controversial as the first one. And that's later on in the year, we'll be exhibiting it, but we're selling it later on in the year. It's one of Jamie Reed's famous designs for the Sex Pistols. And it's their God Save the Queen poster, in which, for those who don't know the poster, Jamie Reed took a very staid photo of Her Majesty the Queen by Cecil Beaton. And he essentially graffitied out her eyes and her mouth using Newstype, which say God Save the Queen, and then the Sex Pistols over her mouth. And then he mounted it on a Union Jack.
So this is from 1977. It's the year of the Silver Jubilee, isn't it? It is also the peak of kind of the moral panic over punk and over the Sex Pistols. And the song, God Save the Queen, well, I mean, there's still some debate about whether it really peaked at number two or whether there was an evil conspiracy to stop it from getting to the top of the charts. I'm actually a little bit skeptical about the conspiracy theory myself. But Tom, are you a big Sex Pistols fan?
I approve of them having happened.
Can you sing God Save the Queen, seeing that you sang at the beginning?
God Save the Queen, the fascist regime, she ain't no human being. I can't remember the rest.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's sort of not the message that Sotheby's wanted.
Yeah, no, that's not the message. But if I said, kind of gets back to what you're saying.
That was Johnny Rotten, of course.
That was a very good impersonation.
Thank you very much. So what does this show? I mean, it shows that, she ain't no human being.
So this is the use of the Queen as it's not quite satire, is it? Because what's it satirizing? Or is it satirizing the cult of the Queen, would you say?
It's quite interesting to think of it next to the Warhol. It's kind of playing off, I suppose, you know, even if you can't, it's playing off both that image of power, the tiara, even without seeing her eyes and mouth, you know that's the Queen.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that the Sex Pistols chose to kick against the Queen, not a prime minister. And
yeah, but it was because it's a silver jubilee and because everyone's been kind of, you know, right royal garden parties and street parties and all that kind of stuff. And this is the kind of stuff of tea towels.
And then they had the boat, remember? The boat on the silver jubilee weekend that sailed past.
With Malcolm McLaren and, blaring it out past the Palace of Westminster. It's kind of sticking it to the man, isn't it? Or I suppose in this case, the woman. I mean, that's the fun of it.
I also think it shows actually in Britain, we're really lucky in that, her reign has been this massive explosion of British creativity, but also, you know, I guess, freedom of speech. People can come up with whatever they want to come up with.
Yeah.
And that's
There was a huge controversy at the time. So do you want to know what the Conservative Law and Order spokesman of the GLC, the Greater London Council, said about this image?
Was he in favour of it as a celebration of free speech and artistic self-expression?
He said it was absolutely bloody revolting.
Did he?
Do you want to know what the Labour MP, Marcus Lipton, said about it?
What did he say?
He said, if pop music is going to be used to destroy our established institutions, then pop music ought to be destroyed first. Oh. I don't know. How would you destroy pop music? I don't know.
Simon Cowell.
Yes, exactly. Maybe he was playing a very long game.
Very, very long game. I mean, it's kind of this kind of Oedipal sequence where artists react against predecessors. So the Sex Pistols famously do that with the Rock and Roll Swindle.
Yeah. You know,
that long list of rock stars who they hate. Who was the one who got chucked out for liking the Beatles?
Oh, is it Glenn Matlock?
One of them got supposedly got thrown out for liking the Beatles.
But the thing with the Queen, though, that's interesting, though, is that this has only happened once. So in the whole course of her reign, and we're up to the Platinum Jubilee now, and in all that time, this is really the only moment I can think of where there's been a cultural backlash.
Yeah.
Obviously there have been moments when her popularity has dipped, but this is the only time I can think of where there have been images like this.
But I would say it's not a reaction really against the Queen. It's the Queen as icon, isn't it?
Yeah.
I totally agree, Tom.
And it's the Queen. So she's photographed by Cecil Beaton.
Yeah.
Who is a kind of the representative of a previous generation of artists.
He's like the ultimate sort of staid society photographer that's what they're reacting against rather than herself.
He used to be my next door neighbour.
Cecil Beaton?
Yeah.
You're old enough to have lived next door to Cecil Beaton.
He had this huge Queen Anne house in Broadchalk, the village I grew up in, and we had the house next door to it.
Did your son has kick a ball? Oh, he wouldn't have kicked a ball. You'd have.
Well, you remember we set up the cricket net on the day that the Falklands War broke out.
I do remember. Listeners will remember.
And we would occasionally hit a cricket ball or kick a football over the wall so that we could go and explore Cecil Beaton's garden. He was very nice. He didn't mind it at all. Occasionally, we'd run into him, and he'd just beam at us cheerfully. So I'm very very pro for Cecil Beaton.
Okay, so you deplore this cover.
Yes, I probably did. No, well, no, I'm sure he enjoyed it.
Okay, so the sex, I mean, that's probably one of the most celebrated images of the Queen. What it is mocking, though, is not the Queen, is not the person Elizabeth Windsor. It is mocking people. It's actually not even mocking the monarchy. It's mocking people's reverence for the monarchy, which is something different.
And sort of, I think it's mocking, establishment.
Yeah.
And I think also the reason why I sort of wanted to talk about it, it also again shows, goes back to this idea of the power of imagery.
Yeah.
Like a very subtle tweak, to her eyes and her mouth.
To me, it's a comic image in some ways rather than a genuinely angry.
Yeah. It is funny.
I mean, it is just funny. It's silly rather than, it's not genuinely scathing or subversive, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, it's not like, do you remember when, was it Saatchi & Saatchi who did that campaign and Tony Blair's eyes were slit into evil eyes?
Demon eyes. New Labour, new danger.
Well, I mean, and as far as I know, I mean, the Queen has never been kind of burnt in effigy or paraded through streets hanging from a gibbet or anything like that. That occasionally happens in, the streets of Lewis, for instance.
Yeah, no, she hasn't. And actually, if you did that, it would be genuinely shocking. Do you not think?
Yeah.
You could burn anybody else. You could burn, Tony Blair has been burned in effigy and has always been burned in effigy. It's sort of fireworks displays next to Donald Trump or something, but no one would burn the Queen. And it would be really, really...
Yes, I think people would be genuinely shocked by that.
I also think it's quite cool because it shows that connection between music and art, such a major thing that Jamie Reid and Malcolm McLaren did.
I think that's really interesting there, though, Francis, is that so 77, when you had the Silver Jubilee, the monarchy was about the last institution imaginable that would ever embrace that sort of pop music art nexus. I mean, when they had the Jubilee, it was as far away removed from the sort of pop culture of the day as could be imagined. And yet you go forward to 2002 or 2012, and the Jubilees then, whoever their spin doctors were, pulled a blinder, didn't they, with Brian May on the roof of Buckingham Palace and Elton John and Paul McCartney and all these characters. Sort of the monarchy, one of the great secrets, I think, of its success in recent years has been the way that it's basically appropriated the energies of popular culture rather than setting itself up as in resistance to them.
Which is what the Queen essentially did with the Commonwealth, to go back to that. That all these kind of revolutionaries and radicals who'd been locked up in prison, you invite them along to a grand banquet and the Queen's charming to them and they all go weak at the knees. I mean, I think that is a definite kind of tendency. Francis, do you have any other object that might in any way link the Queen to giants of rock music?
The one painting, which again, I'll describe it because people can't see it, I wanted to bring into this mix, is a painting by Frank Auerbach. It's a head of Gerda Boehm from 1965, but famously it belonged to David Bowie. So it doesn't really have anything to do on the surface with the Queen, but hear me out.
Or judging by the picture, with the head of Gerda Boehm.
So it's for those who can't immediately conjure up what this picture is, it's an abstracted head of his cousin Gerda Böhm, who he painted for over 20 years. And with all of his sitters, they would come for the same 2 hours, the same day, every single week. And he'd look at them and look at them. He would put paint onto a board or a canvas. He'd take the paint off. He'd scrape it off. He'd add it on. And he was trying to capture the essence of them. So it is quite abstracted. There's so much paint that you almost, if you get up close, it looks like a kind of sculpture of oil. But then a bit like when you do a magic eye painting, if you move further back and you squint your eyes a bit, you can see that there is a head. So David Bowie said about it, it hung at the end of his corridor. So he saw it every morning when he got up and every evening when he went to bed. And he said, I want to sound like that looks.
Wow.
And so what is the link? What links this to the Queen?
So I think this links the period in which Auerbach and Bowie came to prominence in a way. It's a Britain that in the post-war period that was, you know, huge post-war angst. She picked up the reins in the early 50s, just as we were rising from, you know, the embers of the Blitz. That's when Auerbach came as a refugee to London. And I think it's her reign which set the stage for amazing people like Bowie, who, you know, he was the ultimate shapeshifter in a time where all of these different shapes that he shifted, they weren't necessarily, they weren't accepted. And he made it, he sort of blazed that path. And I think it shows actually how in her role as, I guess, overseeing Britain and overseeing the Commonwealth, she's kind of helped to enable that.
So Tom, are you aware of any books written about Britain's soft power during the Queen's reign and the transformation of Britain's image from a sort of Victorian imperialist industrial powerhouse to a nation of entertainers and storytellers? Is there a book on the shelves behind you that maybe... Yes.
Dominic Sandbrook's Pleasure Island.
The Great British Dream Factory is the title.
Of course.
Yes. So, because I have this thesis that basically what happened from the 1960s onwards is that as Britain lost its empire, it kind of reinvented itself and found, I mean, Dean Acheson, the American Secretary of State, famously said this much quoted line about Great Britain has lost an empire and not yet found a role. But I think in some ways, everything that you're saying, Francis, about creativity, which nobody ever said about Britain before the 1960s. So everybody previously said the nation of shopkeepers or pith-helmeted kind of empire builders and all this sort of stuff, even though actually we were quite creative even then. But our self-image as a people who create these kinds of images, you know, avant-garde art, pushing the boundaries of music, you know, in fiction, in poetry, in film, on the stage, you know, that's where our talent lies. And that's obviously Danny Boyle celebrated all of that, didn't he? The 2012 Olympics.
And that is some Sex Pistols, of course. So it all goes around.
Exactly.
The Sex Pistols have become part of the heritage industry.
Exactly. They have become, well, the Sex Pistols are part of the heritage industry now. And that's something that is absolutely emblematic, I think, of her reign. The sort of, when people in the 25th century talk about the reign of Elizabeth II, they'll undoubtedly use a clip of the Beatles to illustrate it, won't they? I mean, there'll be a clip of like Union Jacks coming down in, you know, West Africa or something. And then they'll cut to somebody with a new washing machine and then the Beatles. And they'll say this was, you know, late 20th century Britain. And I think that's actually, that self-image of ourselves as kind of hilariously witty and, you know, creative people is not something that any previous generation of Britons would have said about themselves.
And cool Britannia, let's not forget the 90s.
Yeah.
Actually, David Bowie is one of the few British rock giants who wasn't, as far as I know, assimilated into the... You know, he wasn't dragged into the kind of the tractor beam of Queen Jubilee's performances and things. He never did that, did he? I don't think.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
I mean, and so when he wore Union Jack coats and things, that was like kind of he was a mod. He was There was a strong streak of irony in it.
Well, I tell you what. So we had the great privilege of selling his collection a few years ago, and when it first got announced that David Bowie was selling his collection, everyone thought that his collection would be, you know, international sort of poppy Andy Warhols, Gerhard Richters, what other pop stars collect. What was so cool about Bowie, and I think, again, this sort of speaks what we're talking about, you know, your title, The Dream Factory, is that he was collecting in the 90s, and he didn't buy people like Warhol and Richter. He bought what at the time would have been really quite random British artists, but he bought them because they'd walked the same paths as he. They meant something to him. They came from the same landscape as him. And so they resonated with him. And I think that's another essence of our creativity, that you can't get away from as well, is that maybe it's because under Queen Elizabeth's reign, you know, she's overseen a Britain that inspires people like that. And I think that was the most amazing thing about his collecting. And I suppose that's why I wanted to talk about this picture, just because it sort of shines a light on a slightly unknown part of him. He never did what anyone expected. And what was so great about his art was that it was unexpectedly British.
But I don't know what you'd think about this, that in a way it's actually, I mean, David Brown's kind of classic example in a sense that he was constantly reinventing himself. I mean, that's what he's famous for. He's constantly reinventing himself. But there is a sense in which he kind of slightly ran out of steam. And certainly musically and as an icon, he began to seem a bit tired.
He probably was tired after.
Couldn't you say that about the, you know, that there was a kind of the cycle of creativity, I suppose, paradigmatically began in the 60s. There's quite a strain of self-parody in British popular culture at the moment. It's endlessly kind of reheating half-eaten meals in the microwave.
But I think that's been the case actually since the 60s, Tom. I mean, you could argue people were probably, I mean, I think people were saying that about, you know, Sgt. Pepper or something, that it was cannibalizing Victorian Music Hall. It was, it was back.
Yeah, but they were the first to do it.
Yeah, but I mean,
but I think everyone else is just continuing to do it.
I mean, I think you can definitely argue that the culture produced and during the latter part of the reign of Elizabeth II has been very, you know, obsessed often with our own history, with looking backwards, with constantly reinterpreting. I mean, how often have we talked about this on our podcast? About the sort of introverted, the constant sort of, the fixation on our own history, and particularly the Victorian period, again and again. And in a way, there's some elements of being trapped in a cycle that you can't quite escape.
I guess that's Britain, isn't it? That's part of our eccentric legacy. I mean, in a way, we're lucky. We've got all this history, however turbulent it was, to reference back. Maybe, you know, that's why around the world, Brown Britain, they like the sort of edgy side of it, but then they like that it's placed next to a sort of heritage.
I mean, in a sense, though, it's there in Her Majesty, the brilliant rendition of which we opened this with. But there was a sense in the 60s, and this again is where Sgt. Pepper comes in, and so much of the popular culture of the 60s, that the edginess lay in taking a staid imperial imagery and kind of making it, you know, groovy, making it something kind of enjoyable, Union Jack, miniskirts and waistcoats and things like that. That was the point. But now, I mean, you know, when Jerry Halliwell did it, who cared? Yeah. I mean, everyone had done that. And now what is there to do? I mean, it's such an obvious thing to do now. You know, even the Sex Pistols thing. I mean, that was how long ago? Well, I mean, decades ago. Yeah.
Can I say something that I just realized I haven't mentioned something quite key about one of our exhibition that sort of speaks again to the heritage and what people expect from monarchy, is that we've borrowed all these tiaras to show. And tiaras...
Tom loves a tiara, Francis.
We love a tiara.
Thought so.
So this is your last item.
This is our last official item. And I thought, just to throw it out there, we've borrowed Diana's tiara from her wedding in 1981.
Dominic, you love a wedding, don't you? You love a royal wedding. We actually talked about that. We talked about the royal wedding.
Did I say then how much I disliked weddings generally?
You did. Yes, you did.
My capacity is as Eeyore. So this is Princess Diana's tiara. So obviously worn in 1981, at the absolute sort of nadir of what seemed like the nadir of Britain's post-war fortunes, the summer of 81, because there'd just been the riots in Brixton and Toxteth. There had been
and 3 million unemployed.
Yeah, the hunger strikes in Belfast. Yeah, Mrs. Thatcher was the least popular prime minister since records began and all that sort of thing. And then the wedding of Charles and Diana, you know, Robert Runcie famously says these things about, you know, is it going to be a fairy tale? And obviously, we all know that it wasn't. So there is always that shadow, isn't there? So when you tell the story of the Queen and her reign, I mean, I'm not surprised you have a Princess Diana artifact, but there is always this issue that there is the sort of there are always, you know, there are sort of skeletons rattling in the closet, aren't there?
But do we think that makes, because I suppose it makes the royal family a real family?
Yeah.
In a way. You know, at the one hand, we've been talking about how in a lot of the imagery, they've got to be set on a pedestal. But then on the other hand, they are real people in a real family, albeit with different circumstances and castles that the rest of us have. Actually, in terms of the tiaras, I mean, because obviously there's only, at the moment, it was only noble women and royal women that wore them. They're sort of amazing objects in their own right, though, because you only really, apart from the person who wears them and gets to hold them, everyone else sees them from quite a distance. But when you do see them up close, and we hope Tom and Dominic, you'll come and see them.
I'd love to come.
Yeah.
That they are beautifully crafted objects. There's so much detail that is sort of lost from a distance.
So whose tiara is it? I mean, I know it's Diana wore it, but is it a Spencer tiara or a royal tiara?
So we've borrowed all these things from the families to which most of them all still belong. This is a Spencer tiara. And what's also amazing about these tiaras is normally they're, you know, locked away in safes wherever they are, and they're coming out for a little outing for everyone to see, and for you and Dominic to try on. Well, that's funny. If you close your eyes and think of an image of the Queen, you probably think of her with either a crown, a tiara, or a hat on.
A hat.
I'm now going to think about. Yeah, she's wearing a hat. She's wearing a hat. I've tried it, and she.
There was the great image at the recent opening of Parliament with Prince Charles next to a crown, crown representing.
Well, the crown got its own vehicle. And a lot of people I noticed, sort of people who I imagine who live now in your neck of the woods, Tom, were being sniffy about this on social media.
No, people in Brixton, we love the Queen.
Do you? Prince Charles is, when he...
Prince Charles very popular.
He was always mobbed, isn't he, when he goes to Brixton?
Yeah. He set up all kinds of stuff in Brixton, riding Cricket. Stables and things.
Yeah.
So
good for him.
Yeah.
I'm very much team Prince Charles.
And he owns the Oval, of course.
I have to say. I'm not.
Well, we shall meet on the battlefields of.
Yeah. Well, actually, the truth of the matter is, if it does come to a succession crisis, I would undoubtedly back Princess Anne. I think she has the steel.
Yeah.
Well, she doesn't make as good biscuits as
not
Prince
Duchy original.
Charles's Duchy of Cornwall.
I don't think she has as good literary judgment as Prince Edward.
But I think she would come south, wouldn't she, with a massive horde of Scots?
She would, yes, and they'd all be very good at rugby.
Yeah. I mean, they'd all be.
Well, she'd have the best cavalry, like she wouldn't she? She'd have the best cavalry.
She is. I'm just thinking of claymores. Basically.
And they'd all kind of dance.
Would they? I think they'd be cleaving people's heads off.
No, no, their horses would dance.
Oh, yeah, because that's her skill, isn't it? Is that her superpower?
It's her Olympic skill.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Just one last thing on the Diana thing.
Yeah.
Because it, her death famously created the great crisis for the Queen, and she felt that perhaps she was losing the affection of the great British public. And basically she has, that turned out not to be the case. And I don't know what proportion of people want a republic, about 20%, is it? Something like that.
It's been pretty static, actually. It has grown a little bit, but it's remarkable how weak republican sentiment is, I would say, given, if you were asking people in the 1960s or 1970s, I think they might expect it to have grown more than it has.
But, I mean, a question, which is, when she dies, do you think she will be seen to have made the future safe for monarchy, so safe for Charles, safe for William? Or will her reign seem like something that, lasted so long, and then when she went, everything went? What do you think, Dominic? Because you compared her to, what's his name, the Austro-Hungarian?
Franz Josef, yeah.
Franz Josef.
I'm a big fan of him.
But he reigned for years and years and years, and then
he did. But that only fell apart really because of the First World War, I would say. And I think, I think she'll hand over the baton with the institution in actually pretty good shape, considering how it could have been. If you think about the pressures of the late 20th century, the death of deference, the rise of populism, the sort of unbridled attention of the media. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody coping as well as she coped.
Right. So actually, that's, how will Charles, how will...
Well, of course, we'll be living in a different world then. And actually, I would say, how will they cope? I mean, in a way, the less they do, the better.
Or they bide their time and wait for their loyal henchmen to back them in an unexpected grab.
I'm frank with you. I don't think Prince Edward's ever going to be king, Tom.
We can dream.
Right. Francis, do you think Prince Edward would be king? Final question.
Is this more about a vote, though, for Tom or Dominic?
No, I'm just asking you, do you think Prince Edward, A, has the killer instinct to make a bid for the crown, and B, do you think he'd make a good fist of ruling the country as a despotic, absolute monarch?
I don't think he's going to get to be king.
Okay, well, there you go.
Okay, that's a tough note on which to end. But, you know, we're not afraid to
ask the big questions.
Look at the grim truth and ask the big questions.
So let's just talk a little bit about your exhibition, because I believe your exhibition is, you said it was free to the public. So it opens on the 28th of May. And you've got, am I right in thinking Joanna Lumley is going to be your...
Joanna Lumley is one of the speakers. And all the talks are free. People do need to book those. So just go to sotheby's.com/jubilee and people can book their places. The exhibitions, though, of the seven queens and our 50 tiaras are totally free. You don't have to book for that. You can just come in at any time. We're open from 9 till 4:30. We're doing a children's weekend. So that's when we've got the Battle of the Bears.
The Battle of the Bears, I have to say, the Battle of the Bears is what lure me in rather than the tiaras. The Battle of the Bears sounds amazing.
I had 50 tiaras, though.
Well, the Battle of the Bears, why don't you combine the two and have the Battle of the Bears with them wearing the tiaras?
Or they could fight over the tiaras.
Yeah, or fight with tiaras.
I think 50 tiaras. I mean, that's an impressive number of tiaras. What's a collective noun for tiaras? That
must be a collective.
Exactly.
A glitter. A dazzle of tiaras.
Tommy, you've got such a sort of, you missed your vocation as a tiara enthusiast.
And so we've had six items on this. What other are the standout items that you've got?
So I do have one item, which it kind of links to Commonwealth, going back to what we were talking about. It's a bit abstract. So it's a sculpture by Barbara Hepworth, and it's carved out of a single piece of wood. It's tall and oval, and it has these really elegant, sort of holes in it, I guess. And those holes are painted white. And it was carved in 1945, so just pre-Elizabeth coming to the throne. But it's really special because it's unique, where a lot of her work was made into bronze. And I guess I wanted to mention it because we talked quite a lot about Commonwealth, but I didn't have an object at the time to represent Commonwealth. But I think this sculpture sort of does, because post-war, the British Council were amazing for our artists at getting them out to the Commonwealth. They sort of saw it as a way of having cultural partnerships and of getting our artists out to a wider public. So the British Council sent people like Hepworth and Moore around the world, almost as their like spokespeople, as the Queen's spokespeople,
yes, yeah,
to show how creative we were and what we were making at home, if you like. And I think this sculpture kind of represents that.
There's that point about soft power again, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. And also Hepworth, I mean, she's quite radical. There's very few major female artists, actually, in the pre-Second World War period. There's luckily more now. But, you know, she was like the queen herself, in that she was a rare thing, A, to be a female artist, but to be a female sculptor, that was super rare. She had loads of kids amongst the way, just like, it's pretty amazing. The Queen's four kids, I mean, not as many as Victoria, but you never, that's quite a feat in itself, even though she did all this pageantry pregnant.
And constantly travelling, wasn't she?
Constantly travelling.
I mean, essentially, you know, going back to the origins of the Commonwealth, I mean, basically, whenever there was, a political crisis or something, the government would send her out and she'd be off to India or Ghana or something for months at a time because she happened to go by ship.
And then often, as I said, they'd send artists' works out too as a way, I suppose, of telling the message of Britain to that wider audience. If I have an exhibition of, I don't know, 20 objects, that could tell the story to people wherever it was, in Hong Kong or Nairobi or wherever it be. In a way, I mean, she couldn't visit all those places all the time, but the art objects could.
So right. The exhibition, you need to go to sotheby's.com/jubilee. The big revelation of today's podcast, again, is Frances Christie saying that she doesn't think Prince Edward will be king, and that in the event of the succession crisis, you cannot expect her to be backing Tom Holland's favoured candidate. So on that bombshell, do go to the Sotheby's exhibition, enjoy the Jubilee, and thank you again, Frances, for a really fun conversation, and we'll see you all next time on The Rest is History. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.